Hi, I'm Emily Abbott, the founder of The Brain Possible. We've created this space, our website, and this podcast to offer hope, to explore possibility over limitations, and to create community for families of exceptional children like yours. This is personal to me. I know firsthand that great change cannot come from a place of hopelessness. My son Carter's life taught me to run full steam ahead in the opposite direction of limitations and never to be's. In this work, we know we are not providing one specific solution to one specific problem. We're doing something more, moving toward a transformation of spirit. And we try to spread that message, one connection at a time. Here, on this podcast, we'll begin another. We're so happy that you're taking this journey with us. On the Brain Possible podcast, we talk weekly with practitioners, parents, caregivers, and experts who share their knowledge on a variety of treatments and issues that matter to you. Our guest today is Dr. Jodi Carrington, a child psychologist who put a spin on her career. Instead of primarily working with kids, she pivoted because, as she says, the answer lies in the people who hold them. That means today we're going to be focusing on parents, caregivers, first responders, educators, foster parents, practitioners, therapists, and the big people in the lives of our extraordinary little people. Besides being a speaker and practitioner for over 15 years, Dr. Carrington is also an author. Her first book, Kids These Days, A Game Plan for Reconnecting with Those We Teach, Lead, and Love, came out in 2019 and sold 20,000 copies in just 3 months. Her second book, Teachers These Days, was released on August 1st this year and has been on Amazon bestseller lists. Dr. Carrington believes we are wired for connection. And today in this conversation, we get to explore what that means on a deeper level. Let's get started. All right. Well, thank you so much, Jodi, for joining me here this morning. Let's get started. So what drew you to this work?
Oh, well, Emily Abbott, first of all, thank you so much. I wish we were in the same country, but this is so great that we get to do this even this way. So we talked a little bit about this before we started, but I'm a child psychologist by training, and I'm not a huge fan of kids. I have three of my own, but I am a huge fan of the people who hold them, because I've been doing this work for now almost 20 years, and I can tell you that I've assessed and treated over 1,000 kids in this country, and not one time have I met a bad kid. And what I know to be true today more than any other time if the big people aren't okay, the little people don't stand a chance. So I invest the majority of my time and my clinical practice and my speaking. I wrote a book about it called Kids These Days, which is really all about how do we do a better job of looking after us big people and really normalizing how what a friggin' disaster this parenting job is, and how most of the time none of us have a clue what we're doing, and that's really exactly where we should be.
I just am drawn to your authenticity, because most of the time people don't say all that stuff.
Well, I hear that all the time when I talk about it, but I feel like I don't know how to do it any other way. And I think sometimes, specifically now, the more curated we become in our social media platforms and, you know, trying to sort of like this sort of stress of comparison, we really just need to talk about, you know, so many times, like, we're rolled up in a ball when our kids go to bed and we're crying and drinking wine and, you know, scrolling everybody else's Instagram thinking like, oh my God, they took holiday pictures. We didn't. And I'm, you know, hating my husband, like, we didn't take a holiday picture. Like, look how happy they look. Mm-hmm. How come I didn't marry somebody that can cook? Like, no, you used to be cute. What is happening to you? Anyway, you know, like all of those things, right? So I think when you normalize it a little bit, it makes it just so much more tolerable, right? And I think there's such a part, as a psychologist, I understand this to be so true. You know, you have to name it to tame it. And so much of the time, if we don't acknowledge just what the burden that comes with, you know, taking on the massive responsibility of being a parent and, you know, walking our babies through hard things. It'll sort of eat us from the inside out, you know? And I think anyway, that's the whole platform. That was the whole premise of my book. And when I said to you, I was looking at your platform and I was thinking, oh my gosh, what a great place, because I think it can be such an isolating experience when your babies, in addition to the stress of parenting, are, you know, not neurotypical babies or come with additional challenges that make other people, and I mean sort of other people, I mean so many other people watching us as they do, as we all do every day, you know, judge about what it must be like, or how come you're not trying harder, or what's going on with your child, or have you tried all of the suggestions that you get, right? And you know, everybody's Googled something and like, oh my gosh, you have to like and so that in and of itself, right, you're questioning yourself every other day. And then when you have like the cacophony of, or the litany of people on the outskirts going, oh, what about, have you tried? Oh, you know, and especially when, and anybody, any babe who has a neurotypical issue will struggle most with this thing called emotional regulation. Okay. And I'm just going to jump right in. Like, now apparently it's my show. Are we good?
Yep. Yeah, that's all right. You just go. I had a question down there about that later, but you dive right in.
It's my favorite thing to talk about, because I'll tell you why. I think so long, like, we were both raised in North America primarily around a behavioral model of operating, right? Which says, you make a good choice, I reward you. You don't make a good choice, I punish you. In the hopes that you're going to be good. Okay. And we put a high emphasis in this culture on emotional regulation. We love it when our kids are calm, when they can use their words, if they're able, if they, you know, can make good choices, if they can be kind to their siblings. We like it when our partners are calm. We like it when our employees are calm. We don't like it when people are losing their friggin' minds. And this is an age old question about how do we help human beings be in a state of calm, make good choices, be good humans. Yeah. So if we look back to sort of the beginning of, if I think about my forefathers of psychology, Watson and Skinner, they address the same question by saying, how do we alter the behavior of humans, you know, babies, when they're not making good choices? Well, one fella said to the other fella, look what happens when you shock a rat. Wow. And the other fella said, look what happens when you feed a pigeon colored water. It does it more with this. This is what we should do with children. The whole premise of behaviorism was started on what we learned from a rat and a pigeon.
Oh my gosh.
And still to this day, three generations from now, most of our parenting interventions, our justice system, much of our education system is based on this idea of rewards and consequences. And the issue with a strict behavioral model is that A, it works, which is a problem, because if I have a big enough stick, I can get anybody to comply. But nobody asked the rat, how do you feel about the shocker guy? How do you feel about the guy that just shocked you, right? How do you feel about, you know, do you respect him? Do you want to try harder? What is he teaching you on how to treat other rats? He's basically teaching me that if I just instill fear, then I will get people to comply. And two generations ago, maybe three generations ago, behaviorism was even more effective because we had much more proximity with each other. So relationship was much more inherent, right? If you think about the square footage of the house that your grandfather was raised in versus the square footage of the house in which we raise our babies, right? It's massive. We don't have as much opportunity face to face with our babies to let them know that we're in a relationship. In fact, three generations ago, our great grandparents looked at their children 75% more than
we
do.
Holy cow.
But think about this. We have the distraction of technological advances, and we're getting our kids in all of these activities, and we are, you know, everybody's in their own rooms versus, if I think even just about my father, I mean, he lived in a 400 square foot house, one bedroom, three boys. So every night until he was 17 years old, he and his brothers would sleep together on the floor. And what else did you have to do?
Yeah.
Right. You looked at each other, you've play fought, you built forts, you did all those things. And now tonight, I mean, we text our son when it's supper time and he's in the basement.
Yeah.
On his iPad. You know what I mean? We can't even move our asses down the stairs to be like, hey, what you doing? We're like, so I think part of the why this becomes so important to me is the single most important thing that we can teach our children is this thing called emotional regulation. It isn't actually how to control your behavior. The definition of emotional regulation is basically how not to lose your friggin' mind, how to stay calm in times of distress, And when you bring a baby home from the hospital, regardless of how they're neurologically laid out, the way that they communicate is they lose their freaking minds. They cry. Mm. And the job of big people is to regulate them. And it's actually inherent in all of us to co-regulate with infants, because biologically, if we don't, they die. So we're wired for connection. If you walked out of your house today, or I walked out of mine, or anybody, even if you don't have any experience with infants and there's a crying baby on the corner, you don't walk by and go like, oh, shoot, hope it's okay. We are wired to soothe that baby, to pick it up and engage in some sort of rhythmic exchange. Okay. And that surpasses culture, race, religion, gender identity. We would all engage in the same rhythmic exchange in an attempt to regulate. Yeah. And the rhythmic nature is so important, right? Because the first sound you and me and everybody we've ever met in this planet hear is a heartbeat. Bum, 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 bum. It's the unifying piece of every human being in this moment. And so we know that our job is to get back to that very visceral state of, And the more time kids are surrounded by people who can at least 30% of the time get them to co-regulate, they start to develop those skills to give it away. If they are surrounded by people who are unable to regulate them, even 30% of the time, then they only grow up into this world with fight, flight, and freeze on board. Does it make sense?
Okay. So how do you get there? If you're not already there, or, you know, things are high stress, like they are for a lot of the parents and listeners of this podcast,
Oh, I will tell you it all. Listen, you'll never get there. And that's the point. The point of every human being is to lose their friggin' mind. That's the job, especially of little people. And the job of big people, I often think about this from a quote that I keep over. I mean, if you could see me in my office, there's a quote over my shoulder by a dead guy named Ram Dass. He said this: we are all just here walking each other home. We are all just here walking each other home. And so the job of our tiny humans is really to lose their friggin' minds. And the job of big people is to walk them home again and again and again and again. And now in any typically developing child, whatever that looks like, right? Their job, the chaos is necessary to learn the calm. You can't practice the skills of regulation when they're calm, because they have access to everything you've ever taught them. When you're calm and I'm calm, I am one of the best moms you'll ever meet.
Yeah, me too.
When, right? Oh, I wrote a book about it. If you watch me with my own personal children, you wouldn't buy the book, okay? Because we are so much better when we're regulated. So are our children. When you think about your four, your five, when they are or were most regulated, that's who they are. Because they have access to everything you and dad and grandma and grandpa and auntie and their coaches and their teachers have ever taught them, to use their words and be kind and have their manners and do all those things. Oh, they're brilliant souls. When they start to lose their minds, they go back, or when they flip their lids, they go into fight, flight, or freeze, which is the primitive mode that all of us are born with. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you bring a baby home from the hospital, all they really have to communicate is fight, flight, and freeze. And the job of big people is to soothe, to bring them home. Either I got to feed you or change your bum or decode what the dysregulation is about. And if I do that enough times, you start to get your own skill to regulate for longer and longer periods of time. So eventually I can send you to school or for a sleepover or somewhere away from a primary caregiver so that you can stay regulated. But you will always, just like you and me, we always still lose our minds. If you came out and, you know, slipped on the ice today or got in a fender bender on your way to Starbucks tomorrow, you know, you'll be like, oh my God. So we all dysregulate, and it's very primitive, right? Because I don't want you to stay calm. If you come out of your house in Kansas and there's like a cougar chasing you down the street, I don't want you to be like, wow, that's a nice cat. I want you to flip everything you've learned out of your life. You don't need to know your husband's middle name in that moment. You don't need to know how to judge a heifer, right? You don't need to, I'm from Alberta in a farm town, so cows are always on my head. You don't need to know any of those things. You need to flip those out of the way and what? Fight, flight, and freeze, right? You need to run. So our brains work so beautifully in that way. But with our kids, when they have very little skill on how to regulate emotion, they depend on big people to do that for them. And so when they flip their lids and lose their minds, our job is to walk them home. right? Again and again and again.
How do you do that when, well, me with four kids, sometimes they're all losing it.
Losing their freaking minds.
So
yeah.
What do you do?
Just okay. This is such a good question. The best you can with what you got, first of all. I mean, that's the simple answer, but here, I'll tell you what. We only need to get this right 30% of the time. Okay.
I like that.
On it. Oh, me too. Listen, I put the number 30 everywhere in my house just to remind me that you're doing the best you can with what you got. So here's the interesting thing about kids is that so many times as a child psychologist, I have people coming to me all the time. I'm worried about my baby. I'm worried about my child. You know, he is not making good choices, or they're losing their minds at school, or they're punching their teacher out, or, you know, whatever, they're throwing, hitting, kicking, biting. And people always say to me, can you see my kid? And always, always, always the assessment is important, right? What are we missing, you know, from a neuropsychological perspective? We want to make sure we get, you know, an understanding of an appropriate diagnosis. But typically the treatment program is always, always about the big people, always about the people in charge of walking them home. Because no matter how many times I spend with your baby and teach them strategies, what they need is the big people to understand why they get dysregulated and what it takes to walk them through the hard stuff. And that if you have more stuff in your body, either neurological conditions or sensory disorders or things that make you prickly or an experience of significant trauma, you will get dysregulated quicker, easier, right? It's like you and me, right? When I'm calm and everything's happy, I'm so good. When you put me into labor, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, this is often the example we use when I think about this. When you and I go, like, if you've ever made a birth plan, I know you've had even more children than I have. And with the first one, you are like, I'm going to make a birth plan. I'm going to be so, I go to Lamaze. I'm practicing the breathing. I got the balls and the lavender. Mm-hmm. And I only want my husband and I there. Like, we're good. We don't want drugs. And then I had the whole plan, right? We even talk about it before. We practice the breathing. And then what happens when the first 10-point contraction comes on?
Most people change their mind.
I don't even want to see my husband. I am throwing the birth ball into the hallway. I'm like, the lavender is going to make me puke. So we get dysregulated in that moment. And what we really need is typically it is a very lovely doula or a nurse or somebody or your mama that says, okay, look at me, look at me. Look at me. Women all over the world do this, and you've got this. You understand me? Look at me. And they walk us home. And we never outgrow this need. So the more I'm in pain or the more stuff internally that I have going on, the more intensity we need for people, community, to walk us through the hard thing, which is why often when our kids struggle with mental health issues or non-neurotypical developmental delays, it is so isolating, which is often the part that makes it so difficult, is because you need a village in those moments. You need people to say, I got it, Em. Let me rock him, right? Or, okay, yeah, it's okay. Like, he's amazing. Did you see what he did today? Or, you know, oftentimes when kids have significant challenges internally, developmentally, it's really hard to have them. They're oftentimes they don't have a lot of fans in really structured programs, right? In school, you know, it's always the teacher's like, oh, he can't concentrate, he can't focus, we're struggling with this behavior. And all you just want is someone to be like, ah, I can't wait to see him. Mm-hmm. He's my favorite, you know? Mm-hmm. Because then we just get to drop our shoulders and say, thank you so much.
Yeah. So, okay. When did you decide to shift away from treating children as a child psychologist to focus more on these big people who care for them?
Well, I'll tell you, when I started at the Alberta Children's Hospital, so I did my, it was a teacher that actually changed my life. So I grew up in a really small town in Alberta. We had 20 of us started kindergarten together, the same, like 18 of us graduated together. And it was in, I think we were all in grade 10. We were 16 years old when the most popular kid in our class was killed. Mm-hmm. And I remember where our teacher, one of our teachers in that grade, Mrs. Holly Nordstrom, I remember where she was standing. I remember what she was wearing when she told us about Neil. And I have no idea what she taught us. I have no idea the literacy and the numeracy. I have no idea what curriculum, nothing. Mm-hmm. I go on to get a PhD, but I had no idea what this woman taught us. But I remember how she made us feel. And I remember thinking in that moment, if, even as a 16-year-old kid, if the big people are okay, the little people will be just fine. And I went home that night and I said to my dad, I know what I want to do for the rest of my life. I want to make people feel the way Mrs. Nordstrom made us feel today.
Wow.
And I decided I was going to be a psychologist. And I really thought I was going to be like a sports psychologist. I worked with our police force for a while. So I did a lot of training in trauma and adults and, you know, how we help organizations be better. And then during my residency, I had to do a rotation with kids. And I was like, listen, I'm not a fan of kids. And they're like, you're kind of like one. We think you'd be a good fit. And I fell in love with these tiny humans. I did a bit of a postdoc around child psychiatry. And my first job was on a locked psychiatric inpatient unit for kids. And I worked there for 10 years. And when I started, the primary treatment was around behaviorism, right? So we would put, if the kids didn't make good choices or they were yelling, hitting, kicking, biting, you know, we'd call security and give them a consequence or give them, they called it a loss of privilege. And the hope was when we took away the things they'd love, they would snap out of it and be kind, right? We do stupid stuff like this all the time, like go to your room and we'd taken away your iPad, which makes sense to me, but I don't, that's not the end game. Because what do we think is happening when we send them to their rooms? Do we think that they're going like, shoot, I'm going to try harder? No, they're emotionally dysregulated. And oftentimes when we take that break, the break is for us.
Okay.
When I can pull my stuff back together, then we're going to have to walk home through it. Whoa, 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 whoa. What happened here, bud? How did we get here? And what do we need to do to make it better? Because in that, that discussion, that consequence that you decide on together is really where we start to learn those regulation skills.
So are breaks, are you saying breaks are still okay as long as we end it right?
No, oh my gosh. Listen, let's be clear. Everything's okay because you know your baby's the best. I do not think, I never ascribe to this model of there's the perfect way to do this because you know your five, I know my four, I know all, right? And we live in different cultures and different times and we have different backups and supports. And sometimes we're single parents and sometimes we, the only thing that I ever talk about when I get to speak about, you know, this whole debacle that is parenting is really about giving ourselves grace. Because when we're okay, we are most regulated. Mm-hmm. When we're okay, when we start to give ourselves grace and a break and be like, okay, mama, we get, listen, this is ridiculous times that we're trying to raise these tiny humans in and understand that our job is just to walk them home, to understand that emotional dysregulation is normal and we need it. The chaos is necessary to learn the calm, and emotional dysregulation is the place that as we make sense of the hard things again and again and again, those kids, our children will be able to give that to our grandchildren.
You decided when you were 16 that you wanted to learn, basically you didn't have, did you have the language for it, but you just knew like that basically emotional regulation was what your passion was. And then you started working with children and you were really good at it. But at what point was it with the police force that you just decided the big people needed you? You also worked with Ronald McDonald House as well.
Oh, I love, do you have Ronald McDonald Houses in Kansas?
Yeah. And I stayed in one.
Oh, you did with your babe. Of course. Oh my gosh. What was that like?
Well, I mean, it was nice to have a place to go sleep and not have to leave the hospital.
Right. In the most terrific experiences. Yeah. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's a wonder there, you know, that the purpose, I was a house mom for 2 years when I was in university. And what the definition for that when I was in Edmonton was really, I would check in on a, not check in, I would come in on a Friday and I would leave on a Sunday. And my only job was to love on moms and dads and siblings for, you know, make sure that, you know, we always had lots of donations as you know, you might remember. So people would always bring food and make sure that, you know, they had everything. And so my job was to, whenever parents would come back, was to be their safe place to land, to help them regulate. And the worst thing I could do was talk. The most important thing I could do is do this.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. What people ask me all the time, because I have experience with having my son almost die and then, you know, be on life support. And then he ended up living for 20 months and had a beautiful life, but then he suddenly died in his sleep. And so people ask me often, oh, my friend has, you know, his child was just diagnosed with something or someone just died in their family or what should I do? And even I have been thinking about this a lot lately because I don't even have the perfect answer. So you're saying the answer is to just listen.
Oh, mama. Listen, one of the other things I love to talk about, and this is going to sound like horrific because now, you know, I'm such a popular chick at parties because I like to talk about trauma and grief. Uh-huh. But I will tell you, there is so many things about grief that is so clear to me today, like never before. And when other people we love are in a state of emotional dysregulation or pain, mm-hmm. right? And there's no greater pain, they say, than burying your old child. And we want anybody who loved you, even remotely, all they wanted to do was make it better. Mm-hmm. So they would say so many things like your mama or your husband or your whoever. Okay. Well, at least we got him for 20 months.
Advice.
Right. Or we should, right. And the intention is great. The intention is I want you to feel better. And I just want you to get, are we good? We're good. It's okay. It's good. See, we got through the first year. Okay. We're good. Are you good? You have other kids. You're good. The intention is to heal that heart, but the perception feels a little bit, am I allowed to swear in here? I can't remember.
Oh yeah.
You can edit it. But the intention is like, the intention is to help, but the perception is like, fuck you. Right. And I think so much of the time when we are the griever, when I'm your best friend watching you in a pool of tears on the floor, half of the woman I know you are, all I want to do is get you up and fix you. Mm-hmm. When you are the woman in the pool of tears, what you need is me to sink down beside you and just say his name mm-hmm. and just talk about all the things that we loved about him. Mm-hmm. And all of the ways that he's going to forever be a part of our family and change our life and remember that time. Mm-hmm. What we just talk about in those two experiences is the difference between grief and mourning. Grief is the emotion, the unbelievable response to loss that is intrinsic to all of us. The second you breathe, the second you have the capacity to grieve. Okay. If you're old enough to love, you're old enough to grieve. And it's the grief is an asshole. It attacks you when you least expect it. Just when you think you're fine, you smell something or you hear something and it takes you out of your knees. It is the anguish. It is the pain. It is all of those things. Yeah. Mourning is how you heal. Grief is often done in isolation. Mourning is often done in social relationship. Mourning is when you say, do you remember the time he did this? Or, oh my, he was so funny when he did this. Or do you remember what a little jerk he was? Mm-hmm. At 18 months old, when he pulled down a Christmas tree, do you remember that? Or whatever that is, right?
Yeah.
That's mourning. And mourning is such a testament to grief. And oftentimes, if there's no place for mourning, if there's no place, you know, people don't want to say his name because they're scared they're going to remind you. Right? Mm-hmm. Like as a mom, you ever forget.
Yeah.
People are, you know, don't want to make you sad or sometimes if our children or our partners, you know, are in a different state of grief, we don't want to bring it up or we, you know, all those things. Yeah.
Yeah.
But mourning is how you heal, and specifically holding space for mourning, like things like, and this is different for every family, but I'll just give you some things, you know, that I often hear people talk about is this, at Christmas time, you know, we always hang a stocking for him, or, you know, his picture hangs in our hallway, or, you know, his name is part of conversations, or, and this is true of, you know, our children or our parents or our, I mean, listen, death ends a life, not a relationship, mm-hmm. right? He's always your son.
Yes, I know.
You're always, right? You're always his mom. He's always got a dad. He's always got four siblings. It ends a life, not a relationship. And I think sometimes it is remarkable to me every single day that everybody we meet is in a state of grief or mourning.
Yeah.
Every single person is grieving the loss of somebody they loved because nobody gets out of here alive. Not mm-hmm. one time. And if there's a complication to the grief, if there's a tragic nature to it, if it is untimely in any way, oftentimes the mourning is complicated because people don't have a fucking clue what to say. So they don't say anything at all. And mm-hmm. that's the worst.
Yeah.
Would you say? You tell me.
I would say, and I think the one thing that you had made me remember was, you know, people did a lot of different things for me, sent me different things and mementos and things that some things I cherished and I'll keep forever in a box or something. Nice. But I'll never forget these. There was a couple women. My husband wasn't able to be with me when my son died for like 24 hours. And so I went in a hotel room and some women just took care of me. And I had my period and they were like taking care of that and taking care of making sure I ate something. And they didn't, I don't even remember what they said, but the fact that they were there for me, and the second that I woke up, someone was there to hold my hand. You know what I mean? And that's what you're talking about. Is that just emotional regulation? And I think that is what people need. How do you do that for people who most of us cannot be together?
And here's the interesting thing. Okay. So the more disconnected we become, and this is the truth, in the history of the free world, we've never been more disconnected than we are right now, which is ludicrous to say, because we have so many, you know, technological devices. Mm-hmm. But listen, I mean, we talked a little bit about where you grew up and, I don't think many of us are different in this regard, but I remember as a kid in a small town, like if somebody died up the way, you just went. Like we were in the car and you would go and what you would bring was food, right? Mm-hmm. You didn't say, does anybody have an allergy? No, fuck it. We're bringing all the gluten we can handle and we're just showing up. Right. And now we have so many opportunities to say, to be disconnected in our communication, which is, we'll just send them a message tomorrow, or we don't want to bother them, or, you know, we'll just wait. Okay. Like, God, what if they have an allergy? Oh my God. Just go, just go. And I would much rather have the opportunity to be able to say, like, now's not a good time, but I'm just so grateful you even care, you know, or leave the lasagna on the front deck or what, right? Because we're never meant to do any of this alone. And in this state of isolation, do not underestimate your power of a text. Do not underestimate your power if you're across the country to send a care package. Mm-hmm. To get on your phone and send a video message. Let me hear your voice, right? Just know that, I'm sure, what did you tell me your son's name?
Carter.
Carter. I was going to say Connor and I knew it wasn't right. Mm-hmm. So on Carter's birthday, on the day that Carter died, on anything that mattered to Carter, the friends that say, I'm thinking about your boy today, mama, right? 9 years later, right? Mm-hmm. One of my best friends and I were pregnant at the same time. And she was 6 weeks ahead of me, our first babies, respected first babies. And we went through our whole pregnancy together. In fact, we got engaged 6 months from each other. We were, you know, honeymooned in the same, anyway. So we were really excited about these babies together. She went into labor at 42 weeks and Jillian, by doctor error, died in the birthing process. Healthy baby otherwise, healthy pregnancy otherwise. And so there I am, 8.5 months pregnant, when my best friend comes home without her baby. And I remember, like, I didn't want to see her. I didn't want to talk to her because I didn't want to make her upset. How could she ever be in the same room as me knowing that we had all of these things? And so I just,
you severed.
Oh my God. I waited like this. And, 1 week after Jillian died, her husband called my husband and said, Colleen just wants to see Jody. And I was like, holy shit. And I got to tell you, Emily, I was standing in my closet. And I said to my husband, what can I wear that doesn't make me look pregnant? And he's like, okay, so you're 5'2" on a Ukrainian chassis and you're 9 months pregnant. Like this, we got like a tent is your only option at this point. And so I went. And it was the hardest drive I drove around and around and around and cried many times because I didn't want her to have to care for me. Mm-hmm. And as I walked through the door, I had practiced 100 things to say. And I remember this, I brought her popcorn and I remember thinking I wanted popcorn, not anything that would remind her of girl. And I didn't even want any popcorn that would be like girl popcorn. Like what the fuck is girl popcorn? But anyway, yeah. I decided on dill pickle popcorn. That's what I thought was going to save the day. And I walked through the door and it fell to the floor. Both of us were on our hands and knees and we just, sat there for hours and talked about this baby girl that I was never going to get to meet. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, to this day, she is, regardless of whether we don't talk for months, that never changes between us. And I think that the only point is that you do whatever you can to just show up. And every June 29th, which was Jillian's birthday, the day mm-hmm. of her birth, I make a donation and I tell them where. It's usually to Ronald McDonald House. And I always buy something for her book, because I know Collie has a book for her that, you know, we tucked all of her things in and her photos of her and all those things. And I always want her to know that she's never gone. Right. She's yeah. always part of our six kids. Right. Mm-hmm. She went on to have two more babies. And, you know, Asher was born 6 weeks after Jillian died. And then we had twins. And, you know, it's, she's always a part of it. And I'm never scared to say her name. And sometimes I can tell it's not the right time, or I can tell that, you know, it sort of is that, whew, huh? But I would rather risk that than her ever thinking that for a second I forgot about Jillian, you know?
Yeah. No. And I think that that's true for a lot of parents, you know, most parents who have a child with any kind of a diagnosis. Have you ever heard of this poem? That's kind of random, but Welcome to Holland.
No.
Okay. Well, there's just this poem about how you thought that you were going to have one life, right? Basically, you get on this plane, you thought you were going to Italy or something, and you're preparing to go to Italy, where you're preparing to have a baby, a neurotypical baby. And then they land the plane and you're in Holland, and they're like, nope, this is where you're at. And it's a very sweet poem. And a lot of times parents who have a child with special needs like the poem. But my point is, there's a grieving process and I don't know that. A lot of parents maybe don't give themselves permission to grieve, but they're grieving this life that they thought that they would have and this child that they thought that they would have, but then they're somewhere else.
Yes. And I think if anybody's listening today, here's the biggest issue. Here's your full permission to grieve. It doesn't mean you love this baby any less. It doesn't mean that you can't celebrate this kid. And I think sometimes that's what we fear, is that if we're sad because of the things they're not, we're foregoing the things that they are. Because quite often when I sit with parents who are blessed with babies who have special needs, it comes with such a litany of extra stresses that nobody understands. Mm-hmm. And there is such incredible gifts that nobody could ever comprehend. But there is a loss, a grief that goes a part of that, you know, and you often are spending so much time defending your child mm-hmm. or, you know, advocating for, or getting people just to listen or understand why we can't start the day with a song because he's going to lose his mind. Like, could we come in with no music? Like those kind of things, right? That we are just like, shit, how much easier would it be for you, Cindy? You just get to drop your kid off, you know? And how do we sort of talk about that part about grief, that there's a resentment there, that you get to do all those things with your babies? And so, yeah, I'm interested to hear you say that, because I think that that is so true, that I think sometimes we just forget that, like, yeah, that's necessary. That's necessary.
Yeah. I think grief is necessary, because I've gone through periods of holding it in. And I also want to acknowledge that, yeah, I've lost a child, but I fully believe that whether you lost your job, I know it's different, but if you lost a job and you're out of work for a while, or whatever it is that you may be grieving, I think grief is grief, and you still have to go through this process. It may be different. Obviously, it's going to be different for someone who lost a job versus they have a child. They lost the child that they thought that they would have, or they lost their child from this earth. But you still need to allow yourself to grieve and be okay with it and to go through that process.
Oh my goodness. You're so right. A loss is a loss is a loss. And we often get into the state of comparative suffering, right? Well, at least I didn't, you know, I don't think I have the right to be sad because, you know, I had my baby for 20 months, or my baby died when they were 18. So, you know, obviously I had it a bit better. being very focused on your own experience, because grief is such a unique, necessary process, which is all about identifying what those emotions were like and the regrets and the sadness and the anger. And it's a process, but it's not an end game. You don't arrive at the end of grief, right? You don't, there isn't a day where you're like, okay, hey, good. Grief card.
You're right. You're right.
Got it. It's so good. And I wish that was the case, but grief is so indicative of love. And, you know, if I am, you know, I don't know if this happens in Canada, but up here in Canada, we do this thing. If somebody dies in the community, we put a funeral card, like at the local, like gas station, or like, I don't know why, like, so then everybody knows who's dead, I guess. And you can sort of see like, oh shoot. And if I don't know who this person is, and I'm just like, oh, Mary, she died at like 62. That's shoot, too bad. I can be sad in that moment. But there's no grief in that process because I didn't know Mary. Mm-hmm. If it's my grandfather or my aunt or my mom on that funeral card, my grief is exponentially bigger, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so grief is a matter of how much I loved. They're inextricably woven. Mm-hmm. And so we all experience it, but depending on how much I loved you, it's a direct relationship to how deep the pain is. And I gave the eulogy, you know, at one of my best friends on the planet. She lost her battle to cancer 2 years ago at 44. She left two babies behind. And I said at her funeral, if grief is supposed to be indicative of love, I can tell you, you were the luckiest person on the planet because I have never felt pain like this before, right? Because it is so important to know that the harder it hurts, man, the harder you loved. And I would never trade the two, right? I would do anything to not have the grief, obviously. But it is such an intense emotion that is universal, and that if we're lucky enough to love so deep, oh man, I mean, I just feel grateful every day for those losses that, you know, as hard as they are to fall from, there's a reason they're hard to fall from, because they were pretty, you know, unique experiences to be there.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we talked a lot about grief here.
What we needed to do.
It is what we need. It was on my mind today.
Aww, I love it. And Carter just said, you know what, Mom? It's time. We're talking about me today.
So speaking of like trauma and traumatic experience, you also speak about being trauma informed. What are the struggles that show up in our classrooms and our communities, and how can we support kids and each other in dealing with them? Like, what do you mean by being trauma-informed?
That's such a good question. And it's really poorly defined in the research. And I just wrote a book for teachers as well called Teachers These Days. And it's really about how do we become trauma-informed and relationship-focused. And it's loosely defined. But the thing is, if you've experienced trauma, there is an induction of emotional dysregulation, because the definition of trauma is anything encoded in terror. So there's a few, you know, situations that typically induce terror in children, including things like abuse or neglect and divorce. And what happens in this process is the only way you get through that is you assist in regulating. And the important part about trauma is that if we look at kids' behavior and don't understand the story, then we really treat them in a completely different way. We've come from multiple generations and are certainly embedded in an education system where we ask this question all the time: what's wrong with you? Instead of what happened to you?
Oh, yeah.
And Bruce Perry,
I'm guilty of that. Sometimes.
Yeah. Me, all of us are, right? Bruce Perry and Oprah Winfrey just wrote a book. Dr. Bruce Perry is a psychiatrist and is brilliant in this world of trauma in kids. And his book is titled, What Happened to You? And it's a fantastic read when we really sort of want to understand how we alter the way that we show up in the classrooms, in our mental health programs in schools. One of my biggest commitments as a psychologist is to create a training for mental health professionals in K-12 education that is both trauma-informed and relationship-focused. And we just launched this program this year because every school I go into to do consults, there's a completely different understanding of how to approach the babes who struggle with mental health or neurodevelopmental delays. And I hate it, because when kids get more and more out of control, typically the big people get more and more scared. And so they really ramp up the behavioral programs, which is, let's make a list of their motivators and triggers. Let's try to keep them quiet, mm-hmm. instead of having a plan for what do we do when they get distressed, right?
Okay. So what is it that you wish in that they were doing in schools.
I wish that there was much more question about what is this kid's story mm-hmm. rather than how do we fix this behavior?
Oh, yeah. Because, gosh, that would take time, though.
Okay, so the result of not taking time is then we're putting out fires every day, all day, and we have a completely mm-hmm. burned out education system. Mm-hmm. Versus when I know a kid's story and I can gather a bunch of teachers and a bus driver and a custodian and I could say, look at me, Jackson, this is his third foster home in 2 years. This baby has a history of physical abuse and he's never seen his mama because she's in jail. Mm-hmm. This kid is going to have a really hard time settling every morning because he's living in a foster home right now that has six other kids. And our job is to get his eyes and his heart every morning. I need somebody, doesn't matter who, the bus driver, the custodian, to be able to get his eyes and give him a snack before he starts in his day, which means I'm going to get him regulated. By the time he gets to you, Mrs. A, he's going to be ready to learn. The other thing all of you need to know is that he loves Pokemon and he's a huge fan of the New York Giants. Anybody else have a love of those things? Because if you can light up around this kid, I'll tell you, he'll skate through walls for you. And so how do I orchestrate the big people to be able to serve this baby's, you know, needs so that they can walk him through the hard things? And all of a sudden, this kid does the best he can with what he has, regardless of cognitive ability.
It sounds so simple. We should just do that. That's so logical.
I know. So we created this reconnection training, which really is, I mean, it's an online course. It's a university level course. We partnered with Penn State and we just take mental health professionals from all over the world and train them for eight weeks, do a live clinical day, and then say, go back and do this in your K-12 schools.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Amazing. Yeah. How's it been going? Has it been packed?
Yeah. So the hardest part is we did the pilot and we are just wrapping up our first cohort of 25 people and we have them all across Canada and US and it's been going so great. And so now we just launch officially this week, our next 5 spots. So we're going to start a new course every month in 2022. And I'm just so excited about it. Like it is, you know, sometimes when you do work or you put out podcasts or you put out stuff on social and you're like, yeah, this is good. Here's the 3 tips to do this. This I know will really make a difference, right? Because it's so directed to the people who do the work every day. And here's what's interesting about our relationship, I think, between parents and the education system. If you have a good relationship with your educators, it really is about knowing that half the battle is getting them to love your baby, which means you got to love on them. And so much of the time people are like, oh my God, like I'm so invested in telling the school what they need to do. I have never seen educators more exhausted than they are right now.
Mm-hmm.
And any effort to love on them. And I do this all the time with my kids' teachers. I don't give them gifts at the end of the year. I always front load the ever loving Jesus out of them because I know they're going to love on my kid better. So I'm always like, I'm not giving you Dunkin' cards, gift cards at the end of the year. You're getting them at the beginning. My child's name is Asher.
No, I laughed because my father told me one time that you tip the hotel staff when you get there so that they take really good care of you.
Yes. Same.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I want you to love my baby. And when I orchestrate that and I say things like, hey, Miss S, I just wanted to stop in and say thank you so much. You know, Dylan came home last night and I know he was a huge handful, but you're one of his favorites. And they need to hear it.
Yeah.
Because they spend more waking hours with our babies than we do in the run of a school week. Mm-hmm. And if this idea of emotional regulation matters more than anything, you better be sure that our educators are regulated and are loved on and know that they matter and are acknowledged. Because when they're filled up, they're phenomenal. When they're exhausted, and listen, many of the times they're underpaid, they're undersupported, they're overwhelmed and overworked. I need to love on the people who are there to care for my babies and teach them so that during the day, I can be confident that they're doing the best they can with what they got. It's not about calling the principal and saying, I need these 87 things, which you might, but don't forget your power of acknowledgement because it goes miles, you know, yeah. way miles, miles.
Well, so do you have any practical tips that you can share for our listeners who are hoping to connect more with their own children in their house? What can they start doing in the short term and in the long term?
All right. So let's talk about a couple of things like right today that I want you to think about. Showing genuine interest in the things they love will be life-changing for your relationship. And most of the time, it is nothing you're going to enjoy. So if you have, a babe, you need to be very clear about what's happening in Paw Patrol, what is going on in all of the littles. You can sing all the theme songs. You can do all those things. It gets trickier when they get into those adolescent years, or those preteen years, right? Because we don't like to condone the belly shirts or the excessive TikToking or the whatever. And part of the deal with empathy is if I engage in the things you love, it doesn't mean I necessarily condone it. But I want to learn more about it from you. So I will tell you, I have a 9-year-old who is a TikTok phenom, apparently. And I hate the TikToks. She loves it. So I have our best moments when I say, can you teach me that new TikTok that like Applebee's one when they're like, and she's like, oh my God, mom. No. And there we are making a TikTok together. I despise Fortnite. I strap on headgear and I start shooting people. Okay. Because I need you to tell me what is happening. What is this? Who is this Pokemon? Okay. What is going right? When you know, you go for a drive with your teenagers and you say, all right, what are we listening to today? And they're like, Little Nas. And you're like, well, who? You go with it. You're like, okay. You put it on. Let's go. Let's talk about it. What is it? What did he just say? Penis? Why is he talking about that? Right. But it's this idea that I need to show genuine interest in things you love. And it doesn't mean I condone, support, believe, right? If they're talking about, they want to try a weed pen or they want to, right. We panic all the time with like, no, get off the belly shirt. You're not, you know, let's know. Like, is this what everybody else is doing? Tell me about it. Like, what is the plan with weed pens? Like, what is the deal? Do you know much about
the plan?
Right. But I mean, again, right. We shy. I mean, our parents went through this too. Like the rock and roll is going to kill you. Right. Like think about the movie Footloose. They thought for sure it was the devil, the rock and roll. It's the same thing with the weed pens. It's the same thing with like, what is the new whatever. Right. And the more we don't talk about it, the more trouble we get in. So it doesn't mean you don't support or believe. It means tell me more. Tell me more. What am I missing? What do I need to know? If I was cool today, what would I know about?
Wow. So on my last, this just kind of had, I don't know if this is something you're thinking of, but on my last interview, someone shared with me about this method. I don't know if you've ever heard of what ABA is. Okay. But they were sharing something that's kind of opposite of that. And they said that, so if you have a child, I don't have very experience with autism, but I interview and talk about it a lot with people. And if their child is doing something like an undesired behavior repeatedly, that rather than correcting them and redirecting them, what they found, this couple told me worked with their child, was a method that they learned that had them get down and do the thing with the child that they, the undesired behavior, and they sat there and did it with them. And it seems kind of like exactly like what you're talking about. And eventually the child was like, well, I really trust you.
And the point is, two things happened in that interaction. You got down with the baby or the child, which is so regulating, right? Think about where you have the best conversations with your kids, typically in the car. Why? Because you're on the same level. Okay. If I can, even with babies, and I say even with babies, but anybody, including people on the autism spectrum, where eye contact becomes a difficult issue sometimes, eye contact really matters. If I can get you to look at me, because there's a social referencing that happens with most people, and kids on the spectrum are looking for safety often, depending on their level of developmental functioning. But it's just ideas. Can I engage with you in some way? And so if I'm on the floor rocking or stimming or doing anything, and if I get down and just gently stop my words and stim with you or slow with you a little bit, what I'm going to do is start to regulate. I'm essentially co-regulating. So it's not about condoning or even doing the behavior. So if they're hitting or fighting or biting, it's not that you have to start biting to be able to do the same behavior that they are. But what's so critically important in that process, and you know, I'm not sure what this couple was talking about, but it is, from my perspective, the idea to get down and join in with them.
That's exactly what they're talking about. Yeah. Right. They were talking about spinning plates or something.
Right. So then you co-regulate, right? And then you can say, okay. Right? Wow. Because oftentimes stimming behavior is an indication of anxiety, or I'm doing it because I just need to get back into my head, or because I want, you know, something is happening and I feel overwhelmed. So I'm going to try to get myself regulated in this way. Can I co-regulate with you so you don't have to do that?
Wow. It all makes a whole lot of sense. It works for all people.
Yeah. We're way more alike than we're different.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. Well, we've gone all the way around the block. Thank you so much for your time. I want to talk a little bit about your latest book before we end here. You mentioned it. Can you tell me what was your inspiration?
Yeah. So Kids These Days came out first, and it was really about, and I think it's probably the most appropriate. I mean, I don't really know your listenership, but I think, it's all about emotional regulation in kids and how we walk them through the hard things and why their job is to lose their friggin' minds most of the time. And then I have spent more and more time. I speak primarily for the last, 5 years, a lot to teachers around the world, actually. And I speak to them a lot about the importance of relationships in their classroom. The curriculum is irrelevant if your babies aren't regulated, if the students you teach aren't regulated. And so we really wanted to, I partnered with one of my favorite teachers on the planet. Her name's Lori McIntosh. She's a kindergarten teacher. She's been on the Ellen DeGeneres show a few times because Ellen just thinks she's this amazing teacher. And we wrote this book together, and we really just asked teachers across the land about, you know, what was their biggest lessons in their classroom and how did relationships inform the way that they operated with some of their most successes or some of their biggest, you know, in their minds, their biggest fails. And so we put it together in this book called Teachers These Days, really talking about how we reconnect in the classroom. And so it became a national bestseller, in line with, how we, the success of Kids These Days. And I was so shocked, honestly, Emily, because we self-published the first book and just sort of did it out of our garage, mm-hmm. and it sold 150,000 copies. And then Teachers These Days is nearing that as well now. And it's really such common sense, practical stuff that just, I think, is easy. It sounds easy, but the issue is, how do we stay in the game when things get hard? And so that's really the purpose of both of those books, for parents and teachers.
Is that the two audiences that you see reading that mainly are gravitating towards the book?
Yeah, you bet.
The parents and the teachers.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, how can our audience find out more about you and your work? And I assume they can get the book everywhere.
Amazon. It's the Kids These Days is on our shop. I'm at drjodycarrington.com. I'm always on Instagram and Facebook. I do a Facebook Live every Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning at 7:30 Mountain, where we have coffee. There's usually about 2,000 of us that gather for some coffee. I'm just talking about the hard things and figure out how we're going to survive this COVID infested, drama that continues to push us around. And the whole purpose of our platform is just to create a safe place to land for everybody. And and it's been the biggest joy of my life, for sure.
Yeah. Well, you do it so, you just glow when you speak, and it's effortless and funny, like I said a few times. And I think it has people really relate to you. Mm. And when talking about really difficult things, mm-hmm. it's different than the way most people talk about them.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm it's an honor to sit with you today.
Is there anything else that you would like to share with the Brain Possible community today to be complete?
I would just say the thing that is on my heart the most today is give yourself some grace, because you have been blessed. If you're here in this podcast, you've likely been blessed with the most exceptional babies on the planet. And I think if you only knew just how amazing you are. I think that if you just knew how many people looked at you and were inspired by you and how loved you are, you would be able to drop your shoulders and lean in to do just the next best right kind thing. That's all we're here to do.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time. It was an honor to meet you and to learn from you today.
Thank you, Emily.
Thank you for listening to the Brain Possible podcast. Be sure to tune in every Wednesday for more empowering wisdom, expert advice, and inspiring stories. And be sure to subscribe and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts so that you don't miss out on that one episode that holds the answer you've been searching for. And if you feel inspired, we would love you to rate and review us so that we have the opportunity to reach more people. You can also visit thebrainpossible.com for more information on conditions, therapies, products, and practitioners that can help your family on their journey. Thank you for spending your precious time with us at The Brain Possible. See you next week, and be well.